Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, everybody. And welcome to a live session of the Flight Safety Detectives. We've had a busy week last week because of the competition that I sponsor. And Todd was there, and we worked very diligently to help young people come into the business. Even though we have about 30% of the competitors that compete for $150,000 worth of Snap-on tools, it really is a show for the kids. And although we don't have a final count yet for the number of kids that actually got jobs, it looks like it may be a banner year.
And for those of you who have never been to our competition, which we do at MRO Americas, this is the largest maintenance-related trade show in the country every year. This year was in Orlando, Florida, as it will be next year. And for the last several years, I believe since 2013, the aviation maintenance competition has been taking place in the middle of the conference. So this is a place where we not only allow people to showcase their talents, allow younger people to be introduced to the industry, it's also an opportunity for people throughout that conference to casually walk by and wonder, what's all the excited cheering about? What are all these people working diligently on all sorts of aviation-related things, and why are they having so much fun? And again, the reason for the so much fun part is you, John, because you have been the motive force behind this and were the creator of the current version of the AMC.
Well, I can't do it alone, I'll tell you. We have a whole group of volunteers. We all do it for a labor of love. We don't get paid for what we do. It's a labor of love. It helps the industry get some people, and I love helping young people get into the career field. You know, I wish it was somebody who was out there for me when I came in. It was a struggle in the beginning, but they have helped a lot of people get into the industry, get recognized. And so it's all the airlines are there. All the big guys are there, Southwest, Alaska, American, United, and JetBlue. And the only one who was not on our board is Delta. However, Delta is there, human resources is there from Delta to solicit help from all of our competitors, all the students that are competing. So that's fine too. The whole purpose is to get these kids entry into the industry.
And before we get into the questions, I want to tell you a little bit more about the competition. When we say young people, how young are the youngest people who are at the competition? We had teams from high schools, including a team that was either, I believe they were either high school or right out of high school, who came all the way from Turkey, our first Turkish team ever. 17 and 18-year-olds who were very enthusiastic being there. We have competitors from airlines. We had Southwest, we have United, we have American. We have Azul from South America. And we have various other teams from colleges and universities where they have maintenance programs. Embry-Riddle was there, Spartan College, and several others. A total of 90 teams, around 5 people per team plus some reserves. So we're talking on the order of 500 competitors coming from several countries, coming together once a year to do this thing that we do.
Let's not forget Qantas. They showed up this year with young mechanics. Usually in the past, they've showed up with journeyman mechanics. So this year, they showed up with a whole bunch of young apprentice mechanics. So that was also nice. And you know what? We do one at Verticon as well as MRO. Verticon is the renamed Helicopter Association trade show. And surprise of all surprises this year, because helicopters military territory. We had military teams, we had other schools, and we had a high school team from Dayton, Ohio, which won everything, which left everybody, including me, with our mouths open. Right? The high school team just cleaned the block on everybody. So the talent pool out there is definitely getting better.
And a year or two ago, we had a 19-year-old who was finishing both her AMT certifications and her pilot certifications by the age of 19. So again, this is a profession that has changed and changed for the better. We had, these are questions from folks who responded one of our previous shows. And this is from, let me get his name right. Okay. From Chuckles_K. His general comment was, knowledge and understanding of the entirety of the aviation industry are both underrated no matter your background, interests, or present position. And this was a show we were doing about maintenance a few episodes ago. And the question I saw in his comment was, why should a shortage of mechanics be of interest to pilots? Well, without going into great detail, the show was about a projected lack of maintenance professionals, not just in the USA, but around the world 10 years from now. And he's asking a question, honest question, excellent question. Why should pilots care? John, I think you can answer that better than I could.
Well, what's happening in the business right now, because there's a shortage in the airline side, United Airlines is going to be hiring 7,000 mechanics this year. So where are those mechanics going to come from? We're not producing 7,000 mechanics out of the schools yet. We will be soon, but not quite yet. So that means a lot of the mechanics that are working in corporate aviation and general aviation are now going to be going to the airlines. That means when you have your Cessna 172 that has a mechanical issue, you might have to wait a little while and have to search a little bit to find a mechanic to work on that airplane. So it's going to have a negative effect on general aviation eventually, and actually it's on us right now in the many, many areas of the country. Well, it's very important that we get the supply up. Nobody expected after the pandemic that the industry would come back so quickly. So the airlines and many other commercial organizations offered early out for the maintenance people, and many, many took it. So now we have, the industry is back after 9/11, back big time. Bigger than ever, and we shot people. We were shot pilots, but pilots, a pilot can be made quicker than a mechanic can be made. And it has to do with the width and breadth of the subjects that they have to learn and understand and be able to articulate to the FAA. So it's a little more difficult for a mechanic to run through the system quickly as compared to a pilot. If you got the skills to fly and the money to fly, you can build your 1,500 hours pretty quickly and get out there and get gainfully employed with an airline. And let's not forget that some non-commercial operators hire their pilots for a lot less than 1,500 hours. So, yes, it's a balancing act. And we're unbalanced at the present time. So the struggle
is... you out there might be saying, well, gosh, John just said it might be easier to become a pilot than a mechanic. Why should I become a mechanic? Well, let me tell you about some of the problems we have in aviation. It's a problem for aviation, but it's an opportunity for students who are AMTs. There are industries out there outside of aviation who will hire AMT graduates like that, whether it's space, whether it's the amusement park industry, manufacturing. The breadth of skills that you're required to learn and to be qualified as a A&P, that is airframe and power plant mechanic, is something that gives a foundation that can be taken inside or outside of aviation. So unlike pilots, if you're not hired as a pilot, what are you going to do with all that experience? if you're not hired as an aviation mechanic, oh, there's a bunch of industries who would love to have your experience. Right. So this is not an advocation. I'm not advocating that you get trained as an AMT and leave aviation. I'd love you to be in aviation. But I'm just saying this is the reality. There's a shortage now. There will be a demand later. Probably less of a, more of a demand for AMTs 10 years from now than for pilots. That's just my opinion.
Well, I think it's right. I think the pilots will balance out here relatively quickly. But it's going to take about 3 years before the supply of mechanics catches up to close to the demand. So it will balance out eventually. And I'm just, you and I and about 20 other folks are just trying our best to help streamline the entrance for people that would that have a desire to be in aircraft maintenance.
Now, for those of you out there, I'd like to have you engage your imagination for a minute. Think of the mechanics you might know or might have seen around airports. If you think to yourself, well, gee, a lot of them seem to be middle-aged and such. Yes, that's true. And it's also a situation where when the current generation of mechanics who are going to be retiring in the next 10 years came into the industry had a different dynamic with respect to who were they trying to attract, where the training was, and how readily available it was. Fast forward to now, the people who are out there right now who are thinking about what am I going to do for a career. When I was coming up more than a few years ago, the thought of going into a professional trade was not being pushed, not by the counselors at my high school. The idea was, hey, if you want to get a good job, good solid job, go to college in 4 years, get a good job, etc. Well, that is still true for many people. It's not true for every person. And frankly, the cost of going to a college, even at a public university or a public, let's say, two-year program, is higher relative to people's incomes than it was a few years ago. On the other hand, skilled trades such as aviation mechanic is something that can be done in many cases well under 2 years. In some cases, such as a community college, rather, in Massachusetts, we talked about before, where if you're a Massachusetts resident, you can go through the entire AMT program tuition-free. There are very few tuition-free programs out there at any level of higher education, and there are some here. Also, one can become a mechanic through other routes, and we'll talk about that later in the show. For example, those who are in the military, who are trained in certain aspects of military aviation, might, in the course of their training, be automatically qualified for one of the two or both of the basic certifications you have to get as a civilian. In other words, your experience in the military could transition directly into a position as an AMT, or you'll be, let's just say, ahead of the game with any training program you might have to get to make up the skills gap.
Well, there's been a big focus on military. I've worked with the Department of Defense, even while I was at the NTSB, to help transfer those skills, military skills, to commercial aviation. In fact, my granddaughter, who went into the Air Force right out of high school, ended up marrying a B-52 mechanic, and he left the Air Force about 6 months ago with both his A and his B license, and he was very quickly hired on by the drone operators because of his AMP certificates, not because he needs to where he is because he's working on military equipment, but because of the skills that having that certificate denotes that you have. Right? As you said it, Todd, a few minutes ago, you learn pneumatics, hydraulics, electrical, all through the course of that educational process. And those are the skills that are being in great demand elsewhere. A number of our students from the competition have ended up with SpaceX and other operators of space vehicles. In fact, we had one of our students that competed. I love telling this story. One of our students that competed, and that we saw when SpaceX was running their very first manned launch, the person who closed the hatch, the last person to touch the rocket, was one of our competitors a few years earlier. So it is great to see that kind of skill transfer all about aviation and the opportunity for these kids to go places. Boy, sometimes I really wish I was just starting, because the opportunity that's out there today is just tremendous.
Now, before we move to the next subject, I'd like to tease what I'm going to talk about a little bit later on, AI and space. But before we go there, let's talk about something that's more related to what happened a few weeks ago. As many of you know, there was an accident in LaGuardia Airport where a fire truck was on the runway, on the active runway, and a landing jet hit the fire truck. And there are questions about, well, what's the role of the air traffic controllers? Well, going back to an earlier show that we had a question, or actually a comment, from Fratman Z28, sorry for that, where he said, I think a lot of issues are the age restrictions for the jobs, meaning air traffic controller jobs. You can't get hired after age 31 for air traffic controller when there's an ATC shortage. Need to bump that restriction up to like 45. That'll give a stable job for 10 years before the forced retirement age. A little background there. Air traffic controllers, like pilots, have a maximum age where they can be an air traffic controller, and I believe it's 55 or 56. But the question I saw inside of Fratman Z28's comment was, should the maximum age for an air traffic controller applicant be raised? And I have my opinion, but John, as a former NTSB board member, has a more, how should I say it, intelligent opinion than I have. So
I don't know. What do you think? But yeah, I think that they should raise the age, because we're just boxing out a number of people. Now, you've got to, you know, when you provide the level of training that the government provides an employee, they want to maximize the number of years they get returned for that investment. And that's what they're looking at. And so they want to keep it younger. It's not an easy job for an older person, because it is a pressure cooker. I've been up there in some of those facilities, and boy, it's fast and furious sometimes. So it takes a steady hand. But and as an aside, they just opened up the opportunity to hire 8,000 air traffic controllers ab initio, no school. And they just closed it in the middle of last week, because they had so many applicants in there. So they're opening up the floodgates to bring some people in. But I don't see them raising the age, even though I think they could and should.
My perspective is that there will be a need for air traffic controllers now and in the future. I don't care what kind of automated flight is going to be out there with advanced air mobility and computerized AI aircraft. You'll still need the human element to control most traffic. Now, with any other problem when it comes to a profession that has a shortage of people in that profession, it's a question of money. Are you going to spend money to offer higher salaries to attract people? Are you meaning, let's say, the government, going to spend the money to expand current educational processes that they have? Are you going to spend money to do the research to figure out how do we meaning in this case the FAA, change the system to give other pipelines into this industry that don't exist right now? And are you going to reduce the impediments that are out there to get people in the system? Those impediments could be something as simple as, are you even advertising and marketing the fact that this is a profession that needs people? B, here are the benefits you can get. C, here are the positives of being in this profession. So yes, there is a shortage of air traffic controllers. A shortage can be dealt with. Raising the age is one option that exists. Doesn't have to be the only option. But if there are other options that work well, do that before raising the age. Not that I don't think older controllers can't get the job done, but it's a practical matter. If you raise the entry age, but you don't change the retirement age, there'll be fewer useful years of life of that person's career. So do what you can to get people in the career field. Raising the age, that's an option, but not the first option I'd take.
You know, while we're on the subject of controllers, because it was such a hot issue in the New York accident, we have a couple of activities that we're doing inside flight safety detectives at looking at different areas. And on that crash, that particular crash in LaGuardia, we've been looking at two things. One is colorblindness in the testing that the Port Authority does for their driving on the airport with the color. Because, and this is new to me, the color red, if it originates with digital lighting, has a different impact on our eyes. And don't ask me to explain what that means because I'm just learning about it. But we are going to be digging into that, into the eye test and the effect of the red lights, the force of the power for the red lights, the bulb itself. So we'll be looking at that. We're also going to be looking at that radar transponder. It's supposed to be on all the equipment at airports, optionally on all the equipment at airports. And in New York City, the radar, because they didn't have those transponders, all that equipment looked like a just big blob on the radar screen. And it was not helpful for the controller to be able to identify what truck was where and what direction they were going and so on. So the NTSB is also looking at that in a big way. And the last one that we're working on is something that's near and dear to my heart, and that is the number of maintenance accidents that we have in the business. My last update to what I have was around 2007. So we're going back in now and digging through all those NTSB reports and other reports to see just what effect maintenance has had on the accident rate. And we also continue with the work on CFI, Certified Flight Instructors. Greg had identified a number of CFI related accidents. And so we're looking back 9 years or 10 years, comparing pre-pandemic to post-pandemic on the CFI accident rates. And the initial data that we have clearly shows a trend in the wrong direction. Now, it's not refined yet. It hasn't been verified, double-checked, and triple-checked. But in any event, we will be looking at that and trying to identify whether or not that is truly having an impact on where we are in the industry. So we have got our hands full with all these subjects, but I would like to add that we have a number of people that listen to this podcast that have contributed yeoman's duty to help with all of those subjects. So we have people out there willing to spend their time and their efforts to help us identify these problems and try to get a fix on them. And that's what aviation is all about. All of us have been trying to be proactive in the safety world and trying to prevent the accidents. For years and years, we've had a lot of effort in that area, and it's really heartwarming for us on Flight Safety Detectives to have so many people that listen to the program being willing to help gather the information, analyze, or at least put it in the proper bucket so that we can look at it in the proper light. So I thank you for everybody that's out there.
And that extends to the people who are watching our episode live right now. And we have a couple of questions that have come in the last few minutes. And let's start with one that is related to air traffic controllers from Vukno-Ukraine. If you're from Ukraine, hats off to you for doing what you're doing to keep things going there. And the question was, with respect to the shortage of ATC staff, wasn't the real problem at LaGuardia that there are only two controllers on that late shift? Wouldn't the solution be to roster an extra controller or two? In my opinion, maybe.
Yes, but where are you going to get them from? That's the problem. These towers are operating below the staffing levels because there's not enough of them. So if you're managing that facility, you got to manage the manpower that you have. So you look at the night shift on LaGuardia or any airport, almost any airport around the country, and you say, you know what? There's only a fraction of the flights that are, say, from 3 to 11, from 11 to 5 in the morning, say, I can staff it with less people, or I can have more people during the day. So that's the tough choices that the managers in those facilities have to make. And based upon their past performance at LaGuardia, two controllers working four positions have been at least shown to be okay. Now throw an emergency in there, which was that other airplane that had an emergency. Now that one controller's got three things to do, and that was the straw that broke the camel's back.
And we have a bonus question as well, came in a few minutes ago from Mike 747436. A lot of mics out there. Hi, guy. It's been more than 9 months since the Air India 171 preliminary report. Since then, not a word from the Indian AAIB. That's the Air Accidents Investigations Branch, I believe that acronym is. Have you heard anything on how the investigation is progressing? Let me just say a few things there. Unofficially, there's a whole lot of stuff coming in, not from AAIB, speculation, which I'm all ignoring. And I know of no timeline for the Indian authorities to get the report out. But typically, these reports take a year or more to go through the process. John, have you heard anything specific from inside the investigation that is relevant to this?
Well, what's really relevant is once it turned into a deliberate act by the crew, it turned into a crime. And under ICAO, the International Civil Aviation Organization, when it turns into a crime, it's no longer an accident. You don't have to follow the procedures of putting out a report. And I suspect they won't put out a report. What we do see coming out of India is a whole bunch of snapshots about events that happened during this sequence of events that led up to the crash. And the one that bothers me the most about all this information that's coming from India, it appears to me to be a little CYA on the part of the maintenance organization, the engineering organization, which is separate from Air India, to try to mitigate involvement in this. But the fact that every single report that comes out, unofficial report that comes out, they all ignore the two switches, the fuel cutoff switches. Those switches are analog, they're not computer, and they're very limited in their wiring. The switch does two things. It opens two valves, one on the spar where the fuel tank is, one on the fuel control on the engine, and it does one additional thing. It records the switch position on the flight data recorder. And everybody that's coming up with all these other theories just ignores the fact that we have movement on both of those switches. Now, going down the runway for takeoff, number one shuts off, then number two shuts off. The first officer says, we believe it's the first officer, nobody has said this for sure, that the first officer says, did you do that? And then number one turns back on and number two turns back on. Human factors people tell us that the first switch that you can reach is the, indicates the side of the airplane that that person moving the switch is. So if that's true, then the captain turned the engine off and the captain turns the engine back on. Until you get over that flight data recorder login of that switch moving, the rest of it is all irrelevant.
And let me just say what
I was going to use.
Let me say one last thing about that investigation. By international agreement, there are guidelines by which every signatory to ICAO has to follow. They're not legal requirements. The country of India is up to them how they want to do this investigation, even if they want to finish the investigation. But I do hope they definitively come out and say whether A, it is an accident investigation, or B, it isn't, and when they're going to finish it. And Mike 747436 couldn't agree more. All the speculation is meaningless without the FDR and CDR data. And may I add, with all due respect to Mike 747436, the expertise that is being brought to bear on this event, both inside of India and from the parties from around the world. And follow up to Vukko-Ukraine, staffing problems are really bad. Yes, I live in Ukraine, where we have our civilian airspace shut down since 2022. Only the Ukrainian Air Force flies in our skies for now. And we do hope that whatever is happening now will be in the past, not in the present, and you will get back to having civilian aviation like we do in the rest of the world. But in the meantime, side comment, Ukraine has shown a way that other kinds of aviation, primarily drones and other automation, can transform the battlefield. I hope that knowledge gets applied just as it has in past wars. Once the war is over, That knowledge and insights get applied to the civilian world, making it safer for us all. And we'd like to move to our next subject, where we're going to discuss what we discussed earlier, making it easier for people in the military to move over to civilian jobs in aviation maintenance. And John, you had a absolutely outstanding opportunity to speak to someone who was a major player in the military side of aviation. Let's go back to Idlehands 9842, who asked, what can the FAA do to make it easier for those qualified as a military mechanic to get appropriate civilian certification with minimum hassle? John, you said they're already doing some things. And after you talk about that, I'd like to talk about what you are personally going to be doing in the near future.
Right. So that I've been working for more than 10 years with the military, awesome think tanks with the military is probably a better way of saying it, to help make that easier. And I'm, as I mentioned, with my granddaughter's husband, he came out of the military with both his A&P. So the program is working. Those who don't come out with their A&P for whatever reason, there's organizations, and I know one very well because I sit on the board for it, and that is the Teamsters Union. Without being, it's not a union function, but they'll help do the gap analysis for people who've come out of the military and have some maintenance experience in the military. They'll do the gap analysis, and working with a Midwestern college, they will fill those gaps so that that individual can sit and take the FAA test. Everybody has to take the FAA test. So they'll help fill the gap to make it easier for you to go take the test. So there's a lot of effort, a lot of help out there. And if you got somebody out there that was in the military years ago and like thinking of changing it, get a hold of me, get a hold of anybody. There's a number of people in there, but if you just get a hold of me, go ahead. I mean, I'm available. My last name, first initial at Yahoo is my email. I'm reluctant to give out my cell phone on here, but you know what? 703-597-4502. Just call me. I'll help steer you in the right direction.
And one thing that you did during AMC to directly address that issue, AMC has a lot of, excuse me, MRO rather, has a lot of people walking by the aerospace maintenance competition, one of whom was a Colonel Christopher McDonald II, Marine Corps Colonel, from Fleet Readiness Center East. And he is the executive officer of that organization, which has, I believe he said, on the order of 4,000 professionals, both civilian and military, who are maintaining Navy and Marine Corps aircraft on the East Coast of the United States. And you had a lovely conversation with him. And I believe you and he are going to get together and perhaps you're going to go and speak to Fleet Readiness East in the near future.
Yes, I've signed up to talk to his folks during their next safety stand down. And I also plan on talking to them about when they decide to leave the military, on what resources can be available to them to make it an interesting transition to aviation maintenance. And of course, you know, when we talk about maintenance, there's a lot more to maintenance than just being a mechanic. There's logistics, there's planning, there's a whole host of other jobs. There's probably three other jobs for every mechanic job within the maintenance department. So if you feel like you're not qualified to be a mechanic, you are may very well be qualified to do other things. So, if you get an interest in aviation, come take a look. You might find something that's to your liking.
And I have a couple of things I'd like to talk about. Colonel McDonald, he's a fascinating person. I'd like to know more about him. And he is what in the military they call a Mustang. He started as an enlisted person. And about a year and a half later, which is a fast mover, he went to officer school as a Marine. And he's been a Marine for over 25 years. And he's risen to the rank that he has and has a very important role. And I do hope that he is able to help us get in touch with not only his organization, but with some insights and ideas that can help us make it easier to get people on the civilian side to enter the field.
One thing that came through loud and clear when I was talking to him, the picture's on the screen. when I was talking to him right there, is how caring he was for the people that work for him. It came out loud and clear that he really was looking towards their future. He was looking to help them as much as he could. So my hat goes off to him.
And a quick note before we go to the last part of our show, we had a comment from Mike 747436, again, about Air India. I think your point about criminal investigation of Air India 171 is probably on the money. Hopefully that won't prevent the truth from coming out. I wholeheartedly agree with that.
I think the truth is out. We just have people that don't want to face up to it.
And if it's a question of embarrassing a culture or a country, from my perspective, accidents happen and sometimes deliberate actions happen. They happen around the world, many different countries, many different cultures, and it can be somewhat embarrassing for those industries or those governments, but it's something that just has to be dealt with. And the first time it happens in a large way, and I believe this will be the first time for Air India where something like this has been suspected, it can be tough for people throughout the society to deal with that, even people unconnected with aviation, people who think that even discussing this is besmirching the good name of India. We have no intention of doing anything like that, nor will we in the future.
The facts are the facts. You know, that's why accident investigation boards around the world all stay very focused on the facts. You know, it's not in the facts, it's not opinion, what we're getting out of some people from India and other places around the world is not factual, it's opinions. The facts remain what they discovered, what the flight data recorder gave us. It was only 1,000 parameters on the flight data recorder. I think all of us would be hard pressed to think of 1,000 things that we would want to record. Right? But the most important one on that flight data recorder was those switch positions. And there's nothing that can interfere with that line. It's directly from the switch to the flight data recorder.
And our last question for today from Walter Rarias, 4143, is about the future of aviation maintenance. His question to us is, what can the industry do to take advantage of the knowledge and insight of retired mechanics in order to help train the next generation? Kind of something like what we were doing at AMC during MRO last week. But what can be done?
I know a number of people that have retired that have gone in to teach at AMP schools, if there's an AMP school convenient to them. There's not a lot of AMP schools around every airport, but the ones that are that. And it's not a great paying job because the cost of getting your AMP in a private school is expensive. So the real balancing act for the private education side of the house, it's not really part private, but the commercially available schools, is to try to keep the cost down. So the cost of labor is very high in the education field. So the pay rates are not very high. And there's none of these AMP schools are getting rich either. So that being said, there are a number of old gray hairs, like myself. I teach at Vaughan College in New York City. I teach safety management systems and communications, both critical pieces in aviation, and communications is named in many, many accidents. So in fact, LaGuardia. There are a number giving back. Could there be more? Yes, there could be more. Just depends where the school is and where it is. I travel around the country talking to schools all the time. I go to graduation class. After the competition, I have a laundry list of schools that want me to come talk to them. And I will get to them all eventually. So many of us are doing as much as we can.
And as we end the show, I'd like to first like to thank the audience and my co-host, John, for being with us today, and especially the questions that came in. And we'd like to ask something of all of you who are watching right now. Please like our show and share our show with people you think might want to get in touch with the kind of information we're offering. And we also invite you to email questions to us, flightsafetydetectives@gmail.com. We love your questions. Sometimes those questions make us think. Other times it makes us think about, hey, we should do a show based on the question that you sent in. So please do so. And for you folks out there who are potentially thinking of sponsoring, having us sponsor your product or service, we'd like to hear from you at fsdsponsors@gmail.com. If you have a product or service that you would like to put in front of our audience of interested aviation enthusiasts and aviation professionals, please contact us today. And we'd like to thank our sponsor who's been with us from the beginning, Avemco Insurance. They provide aviation insurance for a wide range of uses, including myself as a rental pilot, training regularly in my 172. I have Avemco Insurance. If you're a plane owner like Greg, who was unable to make it with us here today, you too is a Avemco Insurance customer. And please, if you have insurance questions or if you're not satisfied with the insurance you have now, contact Avemco. And if you have trouble figuring out who to contact, email us. We'll put you in touch with them.
You know, they're good people. They're good people. I spent a lot of time with them not too long ago and listened to them handling their claims. They bend over backwards for their policyholders.
And once again, we'd like to thank you all and hope to see you again next month on our next live show.
Hello, aviation enthusiasts, safety professionals, and curious minds. Welcome to Flight Safety Detectives. We are thrilled that you dropped by. Here, we dive deep into the world of aviation safety, from incident investigations and technical analysis to lessons learned and what they mean for safer skies. As a member of our channel, you get exclusive member-only perks, first access to new episodes, live stream discussions, and Q&A sessions. We are a community of fellow safety detectives who love aviation as much as you do. If you're passionate about aviation or just curious about how things work, we'd love to have you on board. Hit join, ring the bell to be notified, and jump into the discussions in the comments. Strap in, because together we're going to explore aviation safety like never before.